Today on New Horizons, Heather Ray, an independent filmmaker and producer of Frozen River, winner of the Grand Jury Prize for Drama at this year's Sundance Film Festival.
I think of being a producer as kind of being an overseer. I also think of a producer as being someone who is ultimately supporting the vision of the director. Film is kind of in the zeitgeist. I mean, I always say that it used to be when you were in high school, you wanted to be in a band, and now kids want to be filmmakers. You know, it's popular. Out of the blue, and, you know, really was a community endeavor. I mean, it really was about the community and about that team, but it is different than a lot of the work that I've done that has been more sociopolitical.
I'm Bob Custra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to New Horizons. Idaho native Heather Ray is a film producer and director who has worked in the film industry for nearly 20 years. A member of the Cherokee Nation, she formerly ran the Native American program at the Sundance Institute and served as a programmer for the Sundance Film Festival. In 2005, Heather premiered Trudell, a film about the legendary Native American poet and activist John Trudell at the Sundance Film Festival. She has worked in various capacities on several feature films and on more than a dozen documentary films. Last year, Heather produced Out of the Blue, a documentary about the Boise State Broncos' dramatic Fiesta Bowl win against football powerhouse Oklahoma in January of 2007. Most recently, the film Frozen River, which she produced, won the Grand Jury Prize for Drama at this year's Sundance Film Festival. Sony Classics has picked up rights to the film. An adjunct professor of film studies here at Boise State, Heather is currently working as a producer on several forthcoming films. Heather Ray, welcome to New Horizons.
Thank you so much.
Finally, we get to talk to you on this show. I'm delighted. And let's start with some real basics. You could call this movie making 101. We all know from watching the Oscars, if nothing else, when they show the various directors who are up for the awards, they have them on these funny-looking chairs. They're always behind the camera. Of course, they're directing the work of the film. They are the creative directors. What we really don't get to see is the producer in action. What does the producer do? Now, obviously, I have this sense that the producer has to figure out how to finance this film, so you have to run around getting the funding for it. But I know there's also creative aspects to that work as well. And let's start by you telling us the work of a producer.
Well, if you'll notice at the Oscars, when a film wins Best Picture, it's actually the producers who go on stage to receive that award. It's the Harvey Weinsteins of the world. And really, producers are the people who, in fact, you know, bring everything together. I think of being a producer as kind of being an overseer. It's a person who is really seeing all aspects of the production come together and making sure that everything is in check. And so I also think of a producer as being someone who is ultimately supporting the vision of the director, whether it be protecting that vision, helping to shape or form that vision relative to the budget, or, you know, whatever it is. It's a producer is really someone who is kind of managing. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like being a parent.
Well, I just finished watching The Kite Runner. I had read the novel. And for the first time, I was so fascinated by the international aspects of the movie that I listened to the entire trailer, where the novelist, Khalid Hosseini, and the director and one other gentleman were interviewed. And what was remarkable about that particular film is the way they scoured the world looking for the right actors that would work in this international setting in Afghanistan mainly, and Pakistan to some extent. And they ended up finding some towns in China on the border of Afghanistan. And there must be, and I think that's what you were getting at when you talked about being a parent, there must be the point where the director finds the perfect town or the perfect setting, and the producer is saying, hey, that's a great idea, but there is no way we can finance that. So go back to the drawing boards and figure this out. Is that the way that works?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, I think that anytime a director is out scouring the world for location, there's a producer or producers with that director. And I know the Kite Runner's director, and that
was
a challenge, that production. But a producer is always there, you know, balancing things in the decision-making process. And there is a creative process to it. You really are helping to figure out how to do things. When someone is envisioning something, a director is envisioning something, they have to have someone who on a practical level is thinking things through at their side. And so that is a lot of it. It's about realism and it's about problem solving.
Now, I mentioned Out of the Blue in your introduction, and of course, Michael Hoffman was the director of Out of the Blue and worked closely with you, the producer. Were there examples there or instances there when you and Michael had to go back and forth and decide on something? You were working with a very limited budget.
At the onset, we really had to figure out how we were going to do this. And because Michael is, you know, he makes big movies. I mean, he's, you know, a studio director and an accomplished director. And so it was the first documentary film that he'd ever made. And it was also clearly the lowest budgeted project we ever worked on. So in some ways, because I come from the indie world, part of what I was doing was saying, we can do this. We really can do this for this little money. And, you know, with these limited resources, it's a community endeavor. And so, you know, we had to be really creative in how we pulled it off, because we also pulled it off in a very short amount of time.
You sure did. A few months.
Yeah. About 7 months. Yeah.
Are there special challenges for you as a producer and or a director living in Boise and trying to relate to an industry that isn't here? And I want to talk in a few minutes about how more of the industry might come here. And you've been an advocate of that. But it's not, let's face it. And most of us think of the industry as a Southern California industry. So how does that work for you, living here and your husband, Russell? Mm-hmm. You're in business together in a sense, in some ways, mm-hmm. and other ways you're doing independent projects. How does that work?
Well, it's kind of a sensitive question for us right now because we really are dealing with this. It is challenging. Mm-hmm. And since January, I've spent more time away than I have here. Mm-hmm. And we have three kids, and it's really been challenging. I spent a lot of time on planes in the time that we've been here, but also in recent months. And so I think that one of the most important things about being able to do what we do, to work in the industry and be living in a place like Boise, is that there does have to be some level of fostering the industry in a regional sense, fostering the industry locally. And that has been happening. In the almost 5 years that we've been here, I've seen a tremendous amount change, and I've seen the community grow. And I think that the work that the film office has done, which has been, a great deal of the work has been done by our friend Kathleen Haas, who's heading up that office now with Peg Owens, passing that legislation, the bills that were passed, was a really important step toward recognizing the viability of the industry and that it can play a role locally. Mm-hmm. There's a film that I'm producing this year in the coming months that I actually invited the director, who's a New Yorker, to come out to Idaho and just take a look. And she did, and she did make the decision that she wanted to shoot the movie here. I mean, that was really important because that means I get to stay home in, the 2 or 3 months that we're making the film. So it'll take time, I think, to really get the industry to develop to a level where productions can come here, practically speaking. Mm-hmm.
So that's enough to keep Heather Ray and Russell Friedenberg here in Boise?
From your mouth to God's ears, I hope so.
Good, yeah. Good. Well, let's talk about the media incentive bill that was passed earlier this year by the legislature. What are the details? How does that work for the state of Idaho? How does it work for the producer that wants to come in and do a film here?
Well, I want to start by saying that I'm not an expert by any means, and I'm not really as versed in a lot of these programs as maybe I should be. Mm-hmm. The film office is, they've done such great work in creating a bill that is somewhat competitive. There's a 20% rebate, and that's comparable with some of our neighbors. I mean, before passing the bill, Idaho was one of four states that didn't have any kind of legislation around film incentive programs. And now we join the other states in having some kind of program. At this point in time, there's no discussion about a film coming to a state to shoot if there is no incentive. It just won't happen. And, it's still going to take some time because the bill, although passed, is not funded. And that hopefully will come about next year. But the reality is that we cannot talk about film production coming here on a larger scale if we don't have a program that is somewhat competitive. What Idaho has to offer is it's still really a small enough region that it's hospitable. And, aside from the beautiful landscapes and all of that, it actually is in some ways easier to make a film in a smaller area because people are not jaded to the industry experience and really can be helpful and participate. And so I think that those kinds of things make coming to smaller states interesting to producers. But, the reality is, from the financing standpoint, it's a bottom line issue.
Is there still the problem of filmmakers going abroad to save the dollars when it comes to the value of the dollar, for one thing?
Yeah, I mean,
these days?
From my standpoint, it's a problem because it really makes it doable. Yeah. You know, a lot of people are going to Eastern Europe, but not so much to Canada. I mean, we had years of runaway production Canada, which built Canada's industry tremendously. But now, with the dollar being as soft as it is, it's not so much an issue. But people are going to Eastern Europe. We just came from Germany. I was at the Munich Film Festival with one of our films and had a lot of discussions with German companies and producers about what Germany has to offer. And a lot of, well, Michael Hoffman just made a film in Germany. I mean, he shot his film outside of Berlin because of the programs that are available and the regional and federal funding in Germany. So it's, I mean, there's a lot of incentive to shoot elsewhere. South Africa has an amazing program. I mean, it just, you know, it's so difficult to get movies made anyways that we actually need those kinds of opportunities. They're really useful.
Now, Napoleon Dynamite was filmed here, and that's probably the best example we can think of lately as a sleeper film that came out of Idaho, Preston, Idaho, to be more specific. Are there any other films that have been made in the state that have ranked up there?
Smoke Signals, I think, is a great example.
Smoke Signals,
yeah, I mean, I worked on Smoke Signals, and Shomin Alexie is, you know, of course, he's Coeur d'Alene tribal member and Spokane, and we shot there because it was relative to the story, and I think it was a great experience for Idaho and a fantastic example of a film that did well both critically and fiscally. And so that was a successful movie. And I don't know if people associate it with Idaho enough because it really was an Idaho movie. There's been big movies like Dante's Peak and, you know, larger studio films, but there's also been some really great indie films that have been made in the state.
You're listening to Heather Ray. She's Boise's own producer and director, and most recently acclaimed for her film Frozen River, which won the Grand Jury Prize for Drama that we're going to be talking about here in a moment. I remember talking, you mentioned Michael Hoffman, I remember talking to Michael one time about how difficult it is to dredge up the money to do some of the projects. And of course, as you know, he's now working on a film, just finished the film on the last years of Tolstoy's life, and was filmed in Germany, as you say. He was lamenting once upon a time how difficult it is to raise money for films like that as opposed to films that appeal to 13 and 14-year-olds who are filling up the movie theater houses these days. Is that still a problem? I mean, in your work, do you have difficulties when it comes to attracting the investors to a project that isn't as sexy, let's say, as the adolescent films that they know are just going to fill up movie houses on Friday night?
Well, my background in the industry, you know, 20 years, is entirely in the independent realm. I've not produced a studio film. I've sold films to studios, I've sold films to broadcasters, but I've really made movies independently, which means that they've almost entirely came out of private equity. And so when you're talking about private equity and investors, you know, it's always tricky ground. I mean, it's always a sort of a challenge to figure out how to convince someone that a project is worthy. It may be worthy based on content, that the subject matter is valuable, the story is valuable. At the same time, it's really important for the film to be a project that will perform because we have a responsibility to the people that are investing in the films that we're making. The box office is changing a lot. There was an article in the trades in this past week that the scales are tipping now to where the average box office viewer is age 50. And so that makes a difference. I mean, I don't think the teen market is pushing the box office in the same way that historically has. It will always be a solid market, but it really is changing. Women go to movies. No one expected Sex and the City to do as well as it did. I mean, it's moving and changing. And the project that I'm doing this year that I mentioned that's going to shoot in Boise is a coming-of-age story. It's a teen movie. It's not a comedy or kind of, you know, teen sex comedy. It's really a darker story and deals with, you know, teen relationships and physical and emotional abuse and things like that. So it's still a really indie movie. But it has been challenging to raise money for that film, even though it will appeal to a teen audience because it's challenging subject matter. But I think that it's hard no matter what the story is, no matter what the film is.
Sure.
I really do. I think it's a difficult economy to navigate.
There's been an interesting development in filmmaking in that digital video cameras are available now. They're cheap. Mm-hmm. And young people especially can grab these things and start filming. There must be any number of very creative projects somewhere out there on the internet, whether it's YouTube or whatever, that have been done that couldn't have been done a few years ago. Does that change the industry in any way?
It's changed the industry considerably. On one level, you can see it in the volume of films being made has increased significantly, incrementally each year. If you look at the numbers of films that are submitted to Sundance, for example, every year it's considerable increase in films being submitted. And that's because of the accessibility of the medium, by all means. It also has to do with film is kind of in the zeitgeist. I mean, I always say that it used to be when you were in high school, you wanted to be in a band, and now kids want to be filmmakers, you know. So there's just a lot of people making movies. It's popular. At the same time, the technology is changing at the exhibition end. And so, as you probably know, television is changing over in February of next year from analog to digital. It's going to change a lot. It could ultimately mean that you could have an Ethernet port in the back of your television and suddenly you're on the internet. And so what we're hearing in all of these different film forums and festivals and markets and places where people are really talking about these things is that there could be this change in which the network system is democratized in such a way that people can actually have a television network via the internet in a way that they never could via television, where it's millions, if not billions, of dollars to actually have a television network. You could possibly have your own network through the internet. And so maybe a group of independent filmmakers could kind of pool together around a certain theme and suddenly have their own network, you know, on the internet. And so one of the things I think it's amazing and I think that's wonderful, but I think it's also going to create such a barrage of material that the marketing challenges could be insurmountable on how to get one's, you know, attention to one's product. Mm-hmm. So, well, it's interesting what's going to happen, I think, in the next, you know, 3 to 5 years.
Mm-hmm. Well, you touched on Sundance, and we want to go right there because here we have someone who worked at Sundance as a staff member. And maybe you could tell us a little bit about what you did in that respect, but then I want to jump right into Frozen River and talk about your great accomplishment this year. What did you do when you worked at Sundance?
I was at Sundance for 6 years, and I was a program director for the Native American program. I ran the Native program for the Institute. There's the Sundance Institute, which is based in Los Angeles in terms of the creative executives, and then the actual physical institute is at Sundance proper in Utah.
So where did you work?
I worked in L.A.
L.A.
I was one of the creative executives, so I was there. Mm-hmm. And then I worked for the festival half the year as part of the programming team in selecting films and helping to shape the Native program and its role in the festival, as well as the Institute's program. Mm-hmm. So it was a great experience. That's an amazing institution. It really is. It's been around since 1981, and I think it's done a tremendous amount to develop a platform and a voice for independent filmmakers.
And it's Robert Redford's creation? Was mm-hmm. he the guy that got it off the ground?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about the way it's changed. I mean, it was a small festival for independent filmmakers, and it's evolved into a rather glitzy affair, and it's a big deal. It gets the newspaper attention. The top Hollywood talent goes out there. Is that good or bad? What's been lost and gained?
Wow, it's a mixed bag. I mean, it really is. And I've, had these conversations. I just saw Jeff Gilmore in Munich. He was heading up one of the juries there, and he's my former boss. He's the head of the festival. And we were having this conversation, again. I mean, it's such a changing landscape. On the one hand, it's really incredible because it has brought value to independently made films. Mm-hmm. And it really is one of the most important platforms for an American independent. It is the most important platform for an American independent in the U.S. And on an international level, Cannes, Berlin, the group of A festivals in Canada, Toronto, there's only a handful of these A festivals where you can actually platform a film. And on the one hand, it's amazing for independents. On the other hand, what's happened is that the studio system sees it as a marketing platform for their films that are really not independent films, but maybe have an indie sensibility, a different aesthetic than the mainstay of, studio films. Mm-hmm. And so it crowds the platform when you have these films that are not by any means independently made. It crowds that platform in such a way that, it's a marketing mecca. And part of what happens, and I've had these discussions with my former colleagues at Sundance, is that when the press shows up in Park City in January, their focus, inevitably is on Natalie Portman and Chloe Sevigny and, you know, these actors that are in these indie, quote, films, whereas there may be some amazing sort of discoveries that could be made there from true independence. And that's just something that, you know, Sundance works every year to navigate. It's not easy. They really work to bring attention to the films that should be recognized and don't have that kind of power behind them. But it's a mixed bag. It really is.
Let's talk about Frozen River. First of all, I'd like to put the Grand Jury Prize in perspective. Most of us think grand juries are something you sit on, not some prize you get. So help us understand the nature of the Grand Jury Prize, which you received at Sundance.
Let me try and break it down. So every year there are a number of films that are submitted to Sundance. I would say this year that there were probably close to 5,000 feature films that were submitted. As far as American independence, that doesn't include documentaries, doesn't include international films. For the American independent competition lineup, which is 16 films, I would say there was close to 5,000 that were submitted. And so to be one of those 16 films was, you know, from our perspective, amazing. We felt incredibly privileged to be selected for that competition lineup. To come into the festival and by the second, third day, have distributors circulating an interest from my first choice, which was Sony Picture Classics, was also equally kind of astonishing. I mean, all of this, I have to say, I truly gave me hope in independent film because I didn't expect it. I really didn't.
Right.
I thought, okay, we've gotten into Sundance. This is amazing. We'll go. The film will play, you know, well, we hope. But to have an offer from Sony by, you know, the fourth day of the festival, and then ultimately to sell the film, was amazing. And coming into the award ceremony, which is basically a juried award by a group of jurors that come from the industry, this year it was Quentin Tarantino, actress Sandra Oh, Mary Harron, who's directed films like American Psycho, Marsha Gay Harden, the actress.
Right.
Those, you know, this was the jury, basically. It never occurred to me that Frozen River would be a film that would be a real contender for that award, not because I didn't feel that the film was a really well-made film and a very important story, but because I just understand how competitive it is. We were up against a lineup of films, you know, encumbered with movie stars and great directors and all of this, and I just didn't expect it. And, you know, Frozen River doesn't have anyone that's, I mean, Melissa Leo is a lead in the film. She's, we know her as a strong supporting actress in films like 21 Grams and The Three Burials of Melquiade Estrada. She was in lead in a television series called Homicide, Life on the Streets. But she's not an A-list actor. And her co-lead is Misty Upham, who's a lovely Blackfeet girl from, you know, Montana that has been in a few films, but she's certainly not known. And so to see these, you know, these two women, their work be recognized. And then the writer-director, Courtney Hunt, who did a phenomenal job with making a film that is so poignant and so subtle and, you know, so really like old-school movie making. Mm-hmm. I have to say, I was really blown away when we won the award. It gave me hope.
Now, you say the award. It went from 5,000, comes down to 16, comes down to one.
Mm-hmm.
Frozen River.
Mm-hmm.
That's quite an accomplishment.
It was pretty amazing,
I have to say. So you have to tell us, what is Frozen River about?
Frozen River is a story of two women, two single mothers, one Mohawk, one not. And they are in the upstate New York region where there are, you know, a number of Mohawk reservations that straddle the U.S.-Canadian border. They're sovereign nations, so they don't recognize the border. They have their own border, which is their reservation. In the story, these two women come together, you know, inadvertently, really, and end up helping each other out by getting involved in human trafficking across the frozen St. Lawrence River, which goes right through the Mohawk communities in the region. And it's a real issue. There were nights that we were shooting where we could actually see the smugglers coming across the river back and forth with folks basically in their trunks, whether it be Chinese, Pakistanis, people that are wanting to immigrate into the U.S. And, you know,
these are all illegals.
They are.
And,
yeah.
and this is a frozen river, so you're out there filming in very cold temperatures.
We were filming in really cold temperatures. The second day of shooting, our call time was 6 a.m., and everyone, you know, showed up on set where the location was, and it was 38 degrees below zero with the wind chill factor. And, you know, we had to shut down as far as, you know, cameras can't run at that temperature. Right. So it was pretty amazing. And we did shoot on the river. And, you know, of course, we had scientists who were testing it and making sure that it was safe and all of that. But it was a really, it's a very compelling story. And I think it's an interesting story relative to the climate politically in the U.S. because there's a lot of focus on immigration, but it's all focused on the southern border. And this deals with a different border and a complicated issue because they're crossing a border that to the people who live there doesn't exist. But that being said, it's a very divided issue for the Mohawk communities. Half of the community feels like they don't recognize that border, they're sovereign nations, and it's free enterprise. The other half of the community feels like it is a violation of national security and potentially a violation of human rights. And so it's, you know, they're divided completely. But our story, although that's a backdrop, it's the sort of foundation of the plot lines, it's really a story about two women coming together across cultural lines.
Mm-hmm. And the film, it's a serious film. And when you go to Sundance, oftentimes Little Miss Sunshine comes to mind. They're quirky, they're funny, mm-hmm. they're offbeat, and along comes your film. So this didn't exactly fit the bill to begin with when you walked into Sundance with it, I would assume.
Absolutely. And there were some great films this year in that competition lineup, like The Whackness, Choke. I mean, movies that are, you know, larger, broad comedies. And so, and typically those films often are winners. But this story is really, I mean, I've had the opportunity to talk with Quentin Tarantino about it since then. I saw him last week, again, at a festival where we both were, where Frozen River won again, which was, you know, wonderful. And it was interesting to talk with him about it because it really did touch something in him. He's actually part Indian, which I didn't even know.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I thought
either.
That was amazing. And so, and he's from Tennessee and comes from a kind of trailer living life, you know, which mm-hmm. is the subjects and the characters in the film live that life. And so I think that in some ways, interestingly enough, struck a deep chord personally for some of these jurors. That's what was related to me. But I just think it's a story that has a lot of heart and humanity. And those stories, oftentimes, they do prevail.
How long is the film?
It's an hour and a half. It's a 90-minute film.
What's Sony Classics going to do with it?
They are going to release it nationwide. It opens August 1st.
Did you have it down at the Flix?
No. It will be at the Flix in October. It opens August 1st, New York, LA, and then it platforms. Typically, with independent films, they do what's called a platform release, which is it grows kind of city by city. First week, New York, L.A. Second week, they had San Francisco, Chicago, Boston. They just kind of platform it out and allow a sort of street credibility to build and a word of mouth to foster the interest in the film. And so it will ultimately reach Boise in October.
How did you get involved in Frozen River? And in a sense, that's part of an even larger question. Is your work oftentimes a political statement about the way you want to see the world work?
That's a great question, and I would say yes, it absolutely is. I think that, I mean, so much of what I've worked on has been political or social in content, and very often has been, you know, related to the Native community in some way or another, and that's partly because I'm committed to that part of my heritage, and it's meaningful to me, but it's also because those are stories oftentimes that I feel really have not been told. But, you know, I've worked on many projects, and I think the only project I've worked on that hasn't been political in nature has been Out of the Blue, but Out of the Blue, and you know, really was a community endeavor. I mean, it really was about the community and about that team and about the university here, and it was a kind of love letter in a way to that experience. And so I feel like it has value, and it's in a very special way. But it is different than a lot of the work that I've done that has been more sociopolitical.
Well, I just hope that you decide to stay in Boise for a long time and that the state of Idaho gets this film industry going. But wherever you go, we're going to enjoy your work and the work of Russell Friedenberg as well. Heather Ray, thank you so much for joining us today on New Horizons.
Thank you very much.
Next week, Philip Fradkin, author of Wallace Stegner in the American West. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research provided by Kathleen Craven. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to the people who help shape our world in both the Treasure Valley and beyond on New Horizons.